coming back. What's that? Ollie, Ollie auction, free, 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 something like that. Keep coming in. I'm always amazed that it works as well as it does with just about 350 people in a room, right? Yeah, the bathrooms, so well. The bane of our existence, you know. Of course, Jan was talking about plumbing a fair amount. First, I think I want to say, isn't she awesome? Yeah. Yay, Jan! She's out there somewhere, I don't know. Isn't that great? I mean, to be able to talk about stuff like theanine and glutathione and diarrhea and constipation. Anyway, to make it all like really interesting and funny. Like, good job, honey. Let's see, something I also wanted to say, just as a logistical detail, if you can keep the murmuring low or zero while we're presenting here, that'll help other people listen. So just a general comment about that. Also a reminder, especially for people who came in a little late, for whatever reason, including this being a hard place to find, we are recording it, and we'll make the audio available. But if you don't want your voice on the recording, definitely don't use either of those microphones, and think about calling out a question from the audience if you don't want your voice on the recording. If you do call out a question from the audience, I'll repeat it back for everybody to hear. All right? Okay, great. Good, and as I said before in the setup, Jan or I will slow down for specific times of question or discussion, and then we'll keep on going. As you know, and you kind of observed her pace, I'll maintain roughly the same pace, although I will slow it down for some internal experiential activities from time to time. So first thing I want to say is to, you know, my wife lied to you in this one regard, which is my thing here is not really meditation. I teach meditation, all the rest of that. It's been very valuable for me. But that's not really what my stuff is about. She just says that because she's a bad meditator. That's why she says that. You know, of course, I'm a bad eater. I eat what I want, so it drives her crazy. Okay, so anyway, so we'll keep going. All right, so are you ready to rock and roll? All right, good stuff. Strap on. Here we go. Okay, mental methods. Whoosh. Three facts about the mind and the brain. All right. On the one hand, as the brain changes and the nervous system altogether headquartered in the brain, so does the mind. In other words, as different regions of the brain activate, our feelings change, or different muscles, as it were, different regions that perform different functions come online, we are able to do different kinds of things. As the brain improves, the mind changes for the better. That's the good news. For example, if you have more activation, left prefrontal region, you're likely to have a better mood because, in part, the left prefrontal cortex puts the brakes on negative emotion. So if you have less negative emotion, you're likely to have more positive emotion. By the way, as a little sidebar, the sides of the brain bit applies to what I've said just now, applies to right-handed people and roughly half of all lefties. It's just reversed the other way. But I'll generally talk about one side of the brain or another side in terms of the majority of people who are right-handed. Okay. On the other hand, if the brain changes for the worse because of chronic stress releasing cortisol that gradually overstimulates, weakens, and kills neurons in a part of the brain called the hippocampus that helps us make new memories and also put things in context, see the big picture. And also the hippocampus puts the brakes on the alarm bell of the brain. The amygdala and the hippocampus also tells the hypothalamus, another part of the brain, to stop yelling or calling for stress hormones. Right? Well, that creates a vicious cycle. As a part of the brain changes for the worse, in this case the hippocampus, due to literally up to about 25% of its cells dying, as the hippocampus changes for the worse, our mind changes for the worse because we become increasingly vulnerable to stress in a vicious cycle. Stress today wears down the hippocampus, which then becomes less able to buffer us against stress and therefore make us resilient the day after, which makes us even more vulnerable to stress the day after that in a vicious cycle, particularly moderate to high and chronic levels of stress. That's an example of the brain changing for the worse, making the mind change for the worse as well. The second point here, though, is that the second fact is that as the mind changes, the brain changes. In other words, as we put our attention on different things, as we have different feelings, the brain changes as well, both temporarily and in lasting ways. Temporary changes include things like different patterns of brainwaves, which reflect changes of synchronous firing in large coalitions, large populations of neurons. There are ebbs and flows. I'll show you a picture later, and I'll tell you which picture it is later, but I'll show you a picture that's kind of like, aww. You know, that kind of oxytocin moment, And in that moment, yes, more oxytocin moving through the brain, sweeping through the brain. Those are lasting changes. More enduring changes happen when the structure is built, when there are structural changes in the brain as a result of repeated mental activity. In a little bit, I'll show you a slide of changes in the brain of people who do long-term meditation practice. In the saying from the Canadian psychologist Donald Hebb, neurons that fire together wire together. All right. Epigenetics means changes in brain, genetic expression, the expression of genes. So as we have different thoughts or feelings move through us, the expression of genes, little strips of atoms, and the long twisted up molecule of DNA, which would be about 6 feet long if you opened it out, which is pretty wild. Those little strips of atoms that are genes become opened up or unpacked so they can be expressed to do their work. People who routinely practice relaxation. Do you ever relax? This is Marin. But yeah, we got to relax sometime. You know, hot tubs, peacock feathers. Although I think that was more the 70s. But anyway, people who routinely practice relaxation have improved expression of genes in their brain that downregulate the stress response, thereby becoming more resilient. Neural pruning is sometimes called neural Darwinism, survival of the busiest. A toddler has about 3 times as many synapses being little connections between neurons. A toddler has about 3 times as many synapses as an adult does. All right? The synapses, the connections that are not used, wither away and are reabsorbed by the brain, whereas the ones that are busy are the ones that persist. Okay, that gives us what's called these days, it's a mouthful, experience-dependent neuroplasticity. Plasticity simply means the capacity to change structurally. Experience-dependent neuroplasticity. All right, this is the second fact. As the mind changes, the brain changes. That takes us to the third fact. You can use the mind to change the brain, to change the mind for the better. That's essentially self-directed neuroplasticity. Okay, this is a framework. I'm creating a bit of a framework here, and then I'll go into the first of the five great ways, I think, to use your mind to change your brain for the better. here we have a quote from one of the godfathers of cognitive psychology, Marvin Minsky from MIT. The principal activities of brains are making changes in themselves. The brain is constantly changing its structure based on what flows through our mind. The question is it changing for better or worse? So here's a slide of a Tibetan monk expressing boundless compassion to all beings inside a loud and claustrophobic MRI. He's got to really concentrate. So that little orange blob there is in the cingulate cortex, and it exercises top-down control of attention. This is a brain looking that way. And it's not like the rest of the brain has gone dark, although it looks like it, doesn't it? Like a forest at night, a little campfire here. This part's just 2 to 3% more metabolically active. It's sucking up a little 2 to 3% more oxygen. But that's a difference that makes a difference. And it makes sense because this part of the brain is exercising deliberate control of attention. If you're deliberately paying attention here or in other situations, you're going to be working this part of your brain. Interestingly, at the point that people are completely absorbed in some kind of activity, maybe through a flow state of some sort with art or making love or doing some kind of physical thing or being Joe Montana in the pocket, I don't know, some kind of flow state, athletes talk about this sort of thing, or in deep, deep states of contemplative absorption, this part of the brain probably goes offline. There's some evidence for that. And there's a sustained steadiness of mind that's accomplished through other circuits in the brain, which is really quite interesting. There's no longer a need for applied and sustained attention. When that's the case, this probably goes offline. But meanwhile, it does illustrate a point that as your mind changes, so does your brain. This monk is using that function of top-down control of attention, so the particular muscle in the brain that performs that function is drawing more supplies. This can lead to lasting changes in neural structure. I'll present a study here that was done on meditation, but the larger point is applied to really any kind of sustained mental activity. For example, a well-known study, London taxicab drivers who have to memorize the spaghetti snarl of streets there, build up neural tissue in their hippocampus, which is very involved in visual spatial memory. All right, so I'm not trying to privilege meditation per se. I'm just using it as an example. And interestingly, of all the mental interventions in terms of that might have an effect on the brain, meditation has been studied far and away more than any other. I think partly because it's kind of esoteric and cool, partly because scientists wanted to debunk it in the beginning, and partly because some neuroscientists are meditators. So for all those reasons, it's been well studied. But it illustrates a broader point that ongoing mental activity leaves lasting structural changes behind, for better or worse. In this particular study, the resolution is not great on the slide. It's a blobby brain looking this way, as if the brain were like a beach ball that were fully inflated. So the ups and downs, the furrows are now pushed out so you can kind of see them. Point is, long-term mindfulness meditators, who are far from perfect meditators, and any kind of contemplative practice counts, really, whether it's theistic in relationship to something transcendental or divine, let's call that prayer, or whether it's more agnostic or not theistic, like mindfulness of breathing. How many of you, 1 minute or more a month, do something contemplative? Good. No more personal questions. I will not ask you how many vitamins you take. You know, that's Jan's territory. But anyway, okay, so that's cool. You all have some sense of this. Well, these are people like us. They're not perfect. They're Western middle-class types in general, these mindfulness meditators compared to controls. But even though their practices are imperfect, you know, 5 minutes a day, 40 minutes tomorrow, no minutes the day after, attack of guilt, 10 minutes the next day, you know, like that. Okay, they're still getting neural change, which is great. So region number one is in the insula. Part of the brain, there's one on each side, on the inside of the temporal lobes. It's very involved with interoception. If you just take a breath now, maybe through your nose, and you notice that it's coolish going in and warmish going out, just that temperature, that internal sensing of temperature, engages your insula. The insula is also involved in awareness for how you're feeling, especially kind of the deeper layers of feeling, gut feeling. The insula is also involved in empathy for the emotions of others, which illustrates a broader and interesting point or method, which is by mental activity of one sort, you can stimulate the brain, and by stimulating neural circuits, you strengthen them, because neurons that fire together wire together. So by using mental activity A, that's easy, like mindfulness of the body, whether it's putting in golf or doing Pilates or yoga or mindfulness of breathing, whatever, mindfulness of the body A builds up the insula, which then gives you more capacity, more muscle to perform function B, empathy for the feelings of others. For example, that's kind of clever, isn't it? It gives you a sense of, okay, I can use my mind in ways that are resourceful, which is a general point here, you know, to be resourceful and opportunistic in using this information. So insula, another little sidebar, there's two of almost everything in the brain, kind of like Noah's Ark, you know, two zebras, two gophers, two mosquitoes. Those mosquitoes, I don't know about. But anyway, we're sharing a planet with them. There are two insulas, there are two amygdalas, there are two hippocampuses, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But the convention, which is confusing, to usually speak of them in the singular. So that's what I'll tend to do. Okay, so here we have the insula getting stronger, getting bigger, cortical layers thickening, statistically significantly compared to controls. Up here is the front of the brain, more like over here, exercising top-down executive control over attention, which is very central to meditation. And then the third region up here, not very relevant to our purposes, somatosensory cortex, they were tuning into their bodies. In other words, they repeatedly did something, the meditators, compared to controls, and they built structure as a result. This is a study out of Harvard, Sarah Lazar and colleagues, and it was very well done because nobody believed this was true back then, you know, which illustrates also neuroscience is a baby science. This study was just done, you know, about 8 years ago. The other point I want to draw your attention to is this down here. So the blue dot people are the meditators. The red squares are the controls. This was a cohort study, not a longitudinal study, because there's no money for longitudinal studies of meditation, I can tell you that. But anyway, but it was still well done. Here's the deal. We start out life with about 1.1 trillion brain cells, and roughly several thousand are born every day in the hippocampus. It's one of the few places, perhaps even the only place, in the brain where there's any kind of significant neurogenesis, birth of baby neurons. On the other side, even though we start with 1.1 trillion cells, 10% of which roughly are neurons, we lose about 10,000 brain cells a day under normal conditions. That sounds like a lot, but if you start out with 1.1 trillion, we've usually lost a few percent by our 80th birthday. Okay? That leads to what's called normal cortical thinning due to aging, which is associated with normal cognitive decline due to aging. You know, walking into a room and wondering, why did I walk into the room? Maybe walk back. Oh, yeah. That was it. Okay. You know, word-finding issues, not dementia, not Alzheimer's, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But, you know, a significant matter. Okay. Well, so here we have the red square control people, thickness in millimeters, cortex, in these key regions. You can see that the red square people did experience normal cortical thinning due to aging. In other words, older red square people had thinner cortex than younger red square people. But, by contrast, you can see that the meditators did not experience cortical thinning in these regions related to age. They used it again and again and again, so they did not lose it, which, of course, has a lot of implications for an aging population. So what's the takeaway? The takeaway is that our experience matters, right? There's a traditional saying that the mind takes its shape from what it rests upon, for better or worse. The modern update would be that your brain, my brain, brains in general, take their shapes from what those minds are resting upon. If you routinely rest your mind upon anxious rumination, self-criticism, that grumbling case against the people we live with, work with, sleep with. You know, Jean-Paul Sartre, the French existentialist, said, puffing a cigarette undoubtedly, hell is other people. Okay. Well, we get caught up in that stuff. What's our brain going to take a shape of? It's going to take a shape of extra cortisol, a weaker hippocampus, less resilience, stress depletes serotonin stocks, less capacity to have a strong and sturdy mood, even in life's difficulties. That's the kind of shape our brain is going to take. On the other hand, if we routinely rest our mind on the factually positive things in every day, basically wholesome qualities in our own heart, even without needing a halo, if we rest our mind upon the ways in which people are actually nice, if we rest our mind on all the bad things that could have happened but didn't, oh, didn't stroke out today. Yeah, it's a good day. You know, ain't dead yet. Woohoo! No supernovas. Thank you. Yeah, good. Yeah, think about that. Let alone all the ordinary pleasures of everyday life. You know, pleasure is a very underrated mental health intervention. It evolved. I'll get to this later when I get to the fifth one of my five ways to use your mind to change your brain for the better, the one called Coming Home to Happiness, that, you know, we evolved pleasure as a way to come out of stressful episodes and also sustain a very positive baseline. So pleasure. Anyway, if we routinely rest our minds on those sorts of things, over time, we'll have a brain that will change for the better in other ways. That will build up muscles in the brain for steadiness of mind because we're controlling our attention better. We'll build up more sense of resilience, build up a positive mood. We'll have more resources inside. We'll fill up our own cup. We'll put our own oxygen mask on first. So then we'll have more to offer other people, right? The choice is fundamentally ours, moment to moment. We can't do anything about the past, right? You can't even do anything about this moment as it's arrived, but what is under our influence is the next few seconds, really, if not the next few minutes. And in that territory, we can use our mind to change our brain to change our mind for the better. In other words, right here. So that's what I want to talk about with you in a zooming along kind of way. Okay? Any quick questions or comments so far? Right there?
How would you define mind?
Right. Great. I thought there's always one of these people. You know, if you really want to get at that, it's a really good question. It's so fundamental. The way I'm going to use mine is the way that neuro people do, as information. Okay? So if you think about it, the meaning of the words, like that one right there, if you think about it, first of all, we have something physical, the particular shapes of those symbols, or I could say the word, brain. Now, there's a different word in Spanish, which I don't know what it is. Yeah, that, okay? Anyway, that's physical, but it represents immaterial information. So we actually are surrounded with examples where a physical substrate of one kind or another, computer drives, red light, green light, driving here, what have you, represents immaterial information. The nervous system represents, stores, communicates, and operates upon information. Most of that information is totally outside of awareness. The highest level, which, as I said in the beginning, is still mysteriously produced, is a conscious experience. You know, sights, sounds, tastes, touches, smells, the color red, the qualia, some people call it that. But it's presumed that that somehow in the architecture of the nervous system or the mind-brain system, that experience of the color red, let's say, is still being produced somehow by an underlying neurobiological, physical, material process. So that's how I'm going to use the word mind and brain. And my own personal opinion is that at the level of seeing how mental activity, like meditating or learning the streets of London, can change brain structure, the science is really pretty good there. And just being the messenger of this, there's a fair amount of animal research, which troubles me a fair amount, probably like a lot of other people, but that said, I'm just reporting on that information. With animal risk models, you can do, they do, very radical interventions, you know, for better or worse. I think if all the species on the planet got one vote, we'd be gone the next day. You know, I think dogs would vote for us, cats, they'd have to think about it. I think our cat would vote for us. After that, mosquitoes. Well, maybe they like us as a food source. I don't know. But you know what I mean? But that said, with animal models, they do very invasive things. So at the deep kind of detail level, you can find out a lot. At the highest level, conscious experience, you know, thought moment to moment, I think it'll be a while before they really, really figure that out. But in general, that's what I mean by the word mind or mental. Information. Yeah. Now, I should also say, and for those fellow geeks among you, this is called dual aspect monism. It's the idea that, for me, that mental activity requires underlying neural activity, so they co-arise. On the other hand, as they co-arise, different flows of thought, like working your way through a math proof that has a logical quality to it, or progressing through an argument, you know, or in a good sense, you're writing something, you're trying to move something along, or you're just following the streams of information, you're talking with somebody else, that mental activity is forcing underlying neural activity. So to make one causally prior to the other, I don't think makes a lot of sense. Like with a lot of other people, including philosophers, I think in terms of what's called one integrated, interdependent system that has two categorically distinct aspects. Materiality is categorically distinct from immaterial information. But they co-arise in an interdependent, mutually circular kind of way. That was the hardest conceptual thing you're going to hear all day. That was it, and you did it, but it was good. Okay, I better keep going on that one, all right? So, all right, this is my shtick. These five things, this is what I'm going to talk about here. These are kind of my top five. If you're going to use your mind to change your brain for the better, how can you do it? Be on your own side, be mindful, take in the good, rest in love, come home to happiness. This is pretty good stuff, right? Instead of listening to all that glutathione stuff, you know. Just tell my wife. Just you tell her. Okay, so first one. So if you're going to use the power of the mind to sculpt the brain, you got to be on your own side in the first place. How many therapists does it take to change a light bulb? Only one, but the light bulb has to want to change. You know, have you ever tried to change the light bulb of your child, your friend, your parents, your mate, you know, hell is other people, et cetera, et cetera. So we got to be on our own side in the very beginning, right? Otherwise, as Rabbi Hillel said 2,000 years ago, you know, if I'm not for myself, who will be, right? So how to do that. So I want to introduce a couple ideas then. If you're up for it, we'll do a little experiential practice. Okay. So being on your own side. It helps to understand a rationale for this, because actually getting on one's own side, being for oneself, not against others, but for oneself, is actually pretty hard for some people for a variety of reasons, including being very socialized into taking care of other people. So this is where I think Bertrand Russell's quote is quite helpful here. As he points out, being happy makes us good. And also, as a lot of research shows, there's some exceptions to that, but generally speaking, it's when people's own cup runneth over, as I said, that they're more prepared to be giving to other people. Right? Or, as the Buddha says here, if one going down into a river, swollen and swiftly flowing, is carried away by the current, how can one help others across? In other words, if we don't take care of ourselves in a fundamental way, we don't have much to offer other people. Now, there are many aspects of getting on one's own side, but something that's absolutely foundational is self-compassion. There's been a lot of research on self-compassion these days. It's a hot area of research. There are books out by Christopher Germer and also Kristen Neff, who are joining together to do a self-compassion training for people, which is kind of neat, pretty far out. And as you can see in the slide, even though self-compassion, which is simply the wish that a being not suffer, usually with an emotion of sympathetic concern. So self-compassion is simply the application of this warm-heartedness, this good wish, to oneself among all beings. In other words, to the being that wears one's own name tag. Well, even though self-compassion is very fundamental to resilience, to well-being, to recovery from upsetting experiences, Kristen Neff, who, as I said, she did the first published paper, actually, on self-compassion in the West, she has a very autistic son. And she's described to me times when she was on airplanes and her son would have a six-hour tantrum. And you can just imagine being trapped on an airplane, you're the mother of the child who will not stop screaming, yelling, crying, etc. And it's just gone. And it's not the child's fault. He's profoundly hijacked by a neurological condition, basically. And she's getting stares from all the other parents because her child looks perfectly normal. Why aren't you a good mother? Can't you get that kid quiet? You know, what's wrong with you? You're probably one of those California permissive parents. She's actually from Texas, but anyway. And she said, the best I could do is I could just find compassion for my son, compassion for other people in the plane, and compassion for myself. So even though a lot of research shows the benefits of self-compassion, it's not always that easy for people to do. So I have a little trick, if you will, that's neurologically informed, whereby you can kind of warm up the compassion circuits for yourself, and also you can do this if you want with other people. So you want to try an inner practice? Okay. So I'll take you through it, and you can ignore my suggestions all the way or just adapt them to your own needs. That's true for anything Jan and I talk about here. You know, take good care of yourself and, you know, see for yourself, as the Buddha himself said 2,500 years ago. When people do an inner practice, one of two things happen. You either get the result you're hoping for, or you get some kind of obstruction to it, some kind of block to it. But the block itself is often very useful. You know, so if something comes up for you that's getting in the way, like self-criticism instead of self-compassion, it's okay. Just be aware of it. Then make a choice. Do I want to investigate this block and kind of see what I can do with it? Or do I want to acknowledge it? Okay, there you are. Self-criticism. My old friend. Welcome home. Go away now. And then come back to self-compassion. Either way, it's entirely up to you. And then we'll come back and talk about it a bit. And I'll do this in three steps with you. So the first step is to see if you can call up some kind of sense of feeling cared about in the first place. This right here is a little, you could say, artificial. On the other hand, being able to self-activate a useful state of mind is absolutely fundamental to coping, mental health, and spiritual practice or personal growth if that interests you. So if you can, think of someone who cares about you. Could be a human, could be a pet, could be a group of people, could be a spiritual being or force, could be in your life these days or in your past, could be several people. And you're trying to help the idea become an experience. And then you're trying to give it to yourself. You're trying to let it sink in. Feeling cared about, and I'll be quiet in a moment, feeling cared about is on a spectrum. Any place in that spectrum is fine. You know, there is a sense of being included or seen or appreciated or liked or loved on that spectrum. So I'll be quiet for a bit as you just kind of explore and encourage and kindle and try to add logs to the fire of, right now, feeling cared about. And then in the second step, letting the experience of feeling cared about, however it came up for you, move to the background. Now step into a sense of caring for others, especially exploring a sense of compassion. In other words, maybe thinking of someone you care about, wishing that that person not suffer. Perhaps a child you know or a dear friend who's ill or in trouble. Maybe just people in the world in general. You can strengthen the sense of compassion, warm-heartedness, with soft thoughts in the back of your mind like, may you not suffer. Or something specific like, may you find work. Or may you not worry so much about your children. Or may your chemotherapy go well. If you want, you can perhaps strengthen this experience through what's called embodied cognition by putting a hand on your cheek or a hand on your heart. That can strengthen the experience if you want. I'll be quiet again for a few moments as you just rest in and explore and try to open increasingly to an experience of compassion. Knowing what compassion feels like, giving yourself over to it, letting it sink in. And then in the third step, knowing what compassion feels like, swing this compassion to yourself. Perhaps yourself as a child or yourself these days. Being aware of your own stress, your own tension, your own suffering, the ways things are hard for you, you're dealing with a lot, life hasn't been perfect. Just wishing yourself well. You might see yourself kind of outside you. You might get a sense of a younger part of you out there or deep down inside. Or maybe simply knowing, you know, you could strengthen this experience if you like with soft thoughts like, may I not suffer? Or something specific like, may my own chemotherapy go well? Or may I find love? Or may I be at peace? You might get a sense of self-compassion sinking into you, a kind of friendliness toward yourself, you know, a warmth toward yourself, being an ally to yourself, being on your own side, sinking in, receiving this attitude, making room for it in your mind, becoming more and more this way, a little bit at a time. Okay, so moving to an end of this little practice, although it's perfectly okay to continue to wish yourself well, I'll say in passing that research on self-compassion shows that it actually tends to have more benefit than self-esteem training, because I think self-esteem is more conceptual. I've known a number of people who could write a master's thesis on their good qualities who still felt like crap, you know, right? Or felt they were crap. And then the other thing is that self-compassion is very warm-hearted, and studies on brain scans have shown that it tends to prime or activate the motor circuits of the brain, because with this warm-hearted feeling, that there's a kind of readiness or inclination to take action on behalf of those who suffer. So by mobilizing self-compassion for ourselves, there's research support that could help fuel us to take action on our own behalf. Okay? So I'll move on to the next one, and then I'll make a little more room for questions. Okay? Sometimes people think they need to be perfect to deserve self-compassion. I don't know if anyone ever thinks that in here besides me. But and as Leonard Cohen writes here, you know, ring the bells that still can ring. There is a crack in everything. Or forget your perfect offering. There is a crack in everything. That's how the light gets in. In other words, we're all cracked. It's okay. We're all cracked. You know, we're all sinners here in some sense. We're all cracked. And so just because we're cracked doesn't mean we don't deserve care and compassion for ourselves. Okay. On to the next one. Be mindful. All right? So if neurons that fire together, wire together, do so throughout the entire nervous system, that process is turbocharged for what's in the field of focused attention, because Mother Nature wants us to learn from what we're paying attention to. So therefore, attention is kind of like a combination spotlight and vacuum cleaner. In other words, it illuminates what it rests upon and then sucks it into your brain. So if you want to change your brain for the better rather than for the worse, it really is important to get control of that spotlight, right? Because it's what the mind rests upon in terms of its attention in particular that really, really, really sculpts neural structure. The problem is that spotlight of attention is very skittery for multiple reasons. One, if you think about it, animals back in the day who are all zen, oh yeah, lights, leaves, so peaceful, chomp! Right? They were eaten, right? Because the ones that survived were nervous and cranky and, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And we're now today, their great-grandchildren sitting on top of the food chain. Okay. So there's that. And also we have kind of an ADD-ish culture, you know, attention deficit disorder kind of culture. And then, of course, there's normal temperamental variation with sort of spirited ADHD jackrabbits at one end and then anxious, rigid, focused turtles at the other, right, with tweeners kind of in the middle. So there's a natural, normal neurological diversity of attention because the tribe, as we evolved in small bands that bred mainly internally and competed with other bands for scarce resources, bands needed neurological diversity because bands with a mixture of tweeners with some turtles and some jackrabbits could outcompete bands that were comprised of only jackrabbits, only tweeners, or only turtles, which for me is a really useful way to think about the more spirited ADHD end of the spectrum. There's no pathology particularly for being a turtle in fifth grade because it's a turtle pen run by turtles, usually for turtles, to make them better turtles, right? But if you're a jackrabbit in a turtle pen, oh my God, it's not a good fit, even though being a jackrabbit was really useful 10,000 years ago. See, so I have a lot of, I don't think of ADD as a D, it's just, you know, it's a temperamental type. Okay, that said, for whatever reason, people have, you know, varying degrees of control over that spotlight of attention. So getting more control over that attentional spotlight is really foundational for changing the brain for the better. Okay? So to that end, a little cartoon here. Can you read it? In your mind's browser, clear your cache. Now delete your history. Now navigate to a blank web page. One thing I do want to say is that there are so many ways to meditate and there's so many ways to control your attention. You know, and so you just want to find what works for you, right? In the gym, you know what the most important exercise is? The one you'll do, right? That's it. So whatever your practice is, personally, I've made a commitment internally to always meditate 1 minute or more a day. And sometimes that last minute is me sitting down, oh, crikey, I didn't do it today. I'm sitting down to sleep, I'm tired, I'm going to do that. But you might want to take that on, actually, as a personal commitment. A minute. A minute's a low bar. Just about everybody can do it. 15 breaths gives you about a minute, ballpark. Anyway, you might want to think about doing something like that. Whatever that is for you, you know, and it could really vary your thing. Okay. So, yep, little neuro stuff. So, when our mind is wandering, okay, or even we're very focused on a task, we tend to engage, one way or another, circuits in the midline of the brain that are self-referential, right? That refer to a particular perspective or what feels like a point of origin of will, the ego, in a sense, or the sense of the internal I. Well, in this particular study, they basically gave people two tasks. One is to, they showed them some words, and then in the MRI, and ask these subjects to just think about the words, how they applied to them, how they applied in the past, how they might apply in the future, what to do about these words. These were trait adjectives like friendly, irritable, stubborn, curious, etc. And then in the other condition, they asked people to just be with whatever arose in response to the words. Not trying to change the reactions, just let it flow, just kind of relax, and just be with whatever arose. Basically a kind of open awareness practice in mindfulness language. Well, interestingly, when people were doing the first task, the directed attention, self-referential kind of task, they activated networks, the blue blobs, in the middle of the head. All right? On the other hand, when people went out into the mindfulness practice, they activated lateralized networks on the sides of their head, especially the right side for right-handed people. And the point is that getting more capacity to sustain a kind of open, spacious awareness, moment after moment after moment after moment, is a really, really good skill to develop. Because otherwise, we don't have good control of that spotlight. So I want to do a little practice with you, if you like. That's one of the ways to develop more attentional control. This is not particularly a concentration practice, which might use more of the cingulate cortex for top-down control. This is more of a relaxed, open awareness practice, which is another way to be mindful. All right, so you want to try it? So to try it, I'm going to take you out into, good, a sense of body awareness. Here, there are a variety of ways to activate the sort of being with mode, the being mode that those people were doing when they saw the adjectives and just kind of let it flow, all right? And any one of these will be great, and you might find the one that's your personal cup of tea. The one I'm going to do with you momentarily is right here. I think the rest of these are pretty straightforward. Research supports these or plausible elaborations from research. If you're interested in being able to really kind of take this out, for those of you that have an interest in this, more to the deep end of the pool, these two are really good because this midline region of the brain is very engaged in judgments and its neural networks are very densely connected. Whereas the lateral networks are more sort of distributed and less tightly connected, they don't try to connect mental contents together. All right? Tibetan teacher said, the problem is not that we think, the problem is that we try to connect our thoughts to each other, right? In a sense. So in this mode, you're in don't-know mind. It's not duh mind, it's just don't-know mind, and you're not trying to make sense of things. Okay? So, but in particular, I'm going to do this with you momentarily because this is a pretty cool practice, sensing the body as a whole. All right, you want to try it again? Do something experiential? Then we'll take some discussion, okay? So, I'm going to pop to the next slide. So to start with, to do whole body awareness, which initially is a little weird, because the spotlight of attention, even if you bring it to your body, it naturally tends to skitter around. And one thing after another is foregrounded in it. All right. What we're going to try to do here is get more control over that spotlight and widen it to include the whole torso while you breathe, and then the whole body as you breathe, and then the whole body altogether. That experience sometimes occurs for a second or two, then kind of crumbles, but then you can regenerate it, and with some practice, you can be really aware of your body as a whole quite routinely, which if you'll try it, I think you'll see it can just take you right out into well-being and ease. So to just try it, be aware of breathing in your torso and just kind of note some of the sensations, like around your upper lip or your belly. Your chest. And then starting with your torso, so kind of belly up to throat, see if you can be aware of your torso as a whole as you breathe. So I'll be quiet for a moment. Some things that help this work are to soften, kind of like let experience come to you. You know, you're exploring ways to have more mastery over the field of your own experience. You're becoming, in a sense, more competent or skillful at your own experience. And then as you like, bring in more sensations of breathing, such as around the upper lip or inside the throat. Trying to be aware of all the sensations known at once as a single unified gestalt in awareness, moment after moment. And then expand further. You might notice that as you inhale or exhale, your hips move slightly, your head moves as your shoulders move when your chest rises and falls. Extending out to be aware of your entire body as best you can. All the sensations in it known together at once, moment after moment. Then one last minute, as you can, being aware of your whole experience. Just really going out on the deep end of the pool, seeing if you can be aware of all of your experience, as it were, arising at once, moment after moment, sounds, sensations, thoughts, all unified together in the field of awareness, moment after moment. For the next minute. Okay, coming back. So as usual, that was a little exercise of 3-4 minutes worth. It's an experiment. You see what happens as a result. It's not the only way to train attention, but it's one way that I find is very interesting to explore. And so you know, but really extending it out is quite an advanced practice, to have a sense of unification of consciousness of all of your experience at once. But that's something we can do routinely. And when you do it, you're strengthening these lateral networks, which are the foundation of open, spacious awareness. When people in the studies were asked to try to be with their experience, they could sustain this lateral network activation for about 10 seconds. We've all had the experience, right? If you've ever done anything, breath, breath, shopping list. Yeah, right, shopping list. Breath. All right. Anyway, we've lost that sense, right? Well, building up that capacity to stay, breath, or whatever it is you want to stay with, is, of course, a very good muscle to build. All right. Any questions or comments about this bit so far? You're so mellow. You're nonverbal. It's great. Why am I talking? Okay, good. All right, there. Yeah. Yeah. So I'll just very summarily summarize your question or comment there. What about people more on the jackrabbit end of the spectrum, right? Either by, you know, just biologically based temperament or even life culture, life experience, and so forth. What about that with regard to these kind of practices? So I'll make two little comments. One is there's a part of the brain in the basal ganglia, and part of the basal ganglia want stimulation. So there's a natural variation, though, and how much stimulation people want. Jackrabbits want a lot of stimulation. Turtles don't want so much stimulation. And when the basal ganglia doesn't get enough stimulation, it does whatever it takes to get enough stimulation. So suddenly you pick a fight with your kid brother, right? Because that's a great way to get stimulation. Huh? Or drive your parents crazy. That's a wonderful way to stimulate yourself. Or play video games, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So to me, what's interesting is an art, paradoxically, is to stimulate the basal ganglia enough, which is one of the ways the psychostimulants like Ritalin work. They actually, why would an amphetamine derivative calm people down sometimes at the jackrabbit end of the spectrum? So by stimulating the basal ganglia enough, one way or another, let's say through using your attention or increasing the stimulation of the stimulus object, in, you know, being aware of breath in the whole body rather than just here, or having a teacher who's a lot more interesting and quick-moving, you know? Or if you're going to learn about Dickens, see the movie first, then read the book, you know, something like that. If you're that kind of person, you can help yourself. And I think it's really important to do that. I think it's really important to have compassion. That's where we started, for oneself as oneself is, and then build up from there. That's the first point. Second thing I would say is that, on the other hand, this is Coach Rick talking here, but other people have been my coaches and they've made the same point. There's no substitute for steadiness of mind. There's no substitute for the fundamental skill of being able to drop your attention on something useful and keep it there. Or pull your attention away from something that's not useful, like some kind of negativistic rumination, you know? And I think that it's very important to build up that muscle as the foundation for taking control of your most fundamental property, which is this moment of attention. You know?
You need to actively do that for yourself.
Yeah. That's right. And so I think on the one hand, it can help as a bridge to increase the stimulation of things. What's the most important exercise? What's the most valuable exercise? It's the one you'll do. Like I've known people who, on that jackrabbit end, who really are aided in their study by having music in the background. I know others that if there's anything distracting, they're gone. You know, it just really depends on the person, right? But along the way, and this introduces a general idea, you know, it's like bridges to a better place, right? We work something, we build it up, and then we gradually abandon the bridge once we get to the other side. Okay. So I'll go on, actually, and I'm going to stick around afterward for quite a while if you want. We'll just park here and keep going, all right? So I'm going to keep going. Sorry about that. I'm going to get to probably my favorite of the five, taking in the good, okay? First, the bad news. As our ancestors evolved, they had to get carrots and avoid sticks, right? But here's the difference. If you fail to get a carrot today, you'll have a chance at a carrot tomorrow, probably. But if you fail to avoid that stick today, whap, no more carrots forever. So the difference between sticks and carrots is that sticks usually, in terms of passing on genes, which is just about all Mother Nature cares about, sticks have more urgency and impact. So the brain evolved a tendency to be very, very, very aware of the negative. The brain is continually scanning for danger, even when you're mellow and relaxed. There's this kind of ongoing trickle of anxiety to motivate vigilance. For some people, it's not a trickle. It's more like an ongoing stream. And then if something bad happens, the brain reacts to it preferentially. Equally intense stimuli, the brain will pay more attention to negative compared to positive stimuli. And then that experience is immediately fast-tracked into storage. You know, once burned, twice shy. Never forget. Whereas positive experiences have plain vanilla memory systems unless it's a million-dollar moment, a very novel, intense experience. Plain vanilla memory systems have short-term buffers and long-term storage. And as anyone who's ever tried to memorize a phone number or a license plate knows, you need to hold that information in short-term memory buffers, 5, 10, 15, and maybe even 20 seconds in a row, for it to really transfer to long-term storage and learning to occur, which means change in neural structure. But with positive experiences, how often are we actually doing that? Right? We might be having a positive experience, brief positive experience, neutral experience, positive experience, next positive experience, another positive experience after that. None of them stay in short-term buffers long enough past that loose threshold that's around 5, 10, or 20 seconds to transfer to long-term storage. From the standpoint of the brain, they're wasted. This is the fundamental weakness in psychotherapy, mindfulness training, character education, both formal and informal efforts. You know, we're activating these positive states, great, but the positive state is not being sustained long enough to turn into a neural trait, right? Whereas the negative ones, kaboom, they're registered right off the top. For example, research on couples shows that you need about a 5-to-1 ratio of positive to negative interactions just to kind of be above water line. Well, that's a cautionary tale to think about the last few days, you know? Learn helplessness. It's very easy to train mammals, humans, dogs, what have you, into a sense of futility and defeat. But then it usually takes 5-10 times as many, if not more, counter experiences of agency, efficacy, capacity to help unlearn that helplessness. Or think about 20 things happen in a day, right? 10 are mildly positive, 9 are neutral, 1 was mildly negative. What's the one we tend to think about, right? Yeah, when we're falling asleep. So what to do about this? This is where taking in the good comes in, but I want to put it in context. I think there are three great ways to engage the mind. The fourth is to transcend the mind altogether, but that's outside of the frame we're working in here. So inside the frame of ordinary ways to engage the mind, we can just be with it, just watch it, not try to change it. It is what it is. Or we can reduce negatives, or we can increase positives. I think that's kind of it. All are really important. Taking in the good is the third. You know, if the mind were a garden, you can watch your garden. You can pull weeds. That's the second. Or third, you could plant flowers. Taking in the good, which we'll do momentarily, is about planting flowers. But obviously, it's not the only way to engage the mind. In my view, the first way to engage the mind has gotten excessively privileged and prioritized, and sometimes the other two are actually seen as bad, that it's somehow bad to make deliberate, goal-directed efforts to pull weeds or plant flowers in the garden of the mind. I think being with the mind, just accepting it, letting it run, relating to it with open awareness, is profoundly important. I think it's the foundation because it has deep, deep teachings available in it, and it's your last resort because sometimes you can't reduce the negative or grow the positive. On the other hand, if we're just being with what's there past the point that's useful, oh yeah, my mother's stuff. Yeah, my mother's stuff. I know what that feels like. Yep, still got my, then my father in there too. Oh my God. You know, it's like the Addams Family. Oh my God. You know, well, past the point that's useful, that's like doing laps around the track in hell, just digging the track deeper every time you go, because neurons that fire together wire together, right? And also to just be with our experience, to feel our feelings and so forth, sometimes we have to resource ourselves by doing the third thing of building up resources inside to be able to tolerate our own experience. Otherwise, it's like popping open a trapdoor to hell. Okay? So it's in this context now that I want to talk about taking in the good. Okay? So, four steps to take in the good. Third, the fourth one's optional. We'll do this momentarily. The acronym HEAL is helpful. Have a positive experience in the first place. Number one, if you want to know how to take in the good, the summary is have it, enjoy it. That's it. Have the experience in the first place, and then once you're having it, enjoy it. Stay with it. This cookie tastes good. These are nice people. Still breathing, not dead. I like breathing. Breathing is much better than the alternative. Good, you know, right? So have it in the first place. Activate it. You cannot build strengths inside. We cannot grow strengths inside unless we have an experience of them in the first place. We cannot become happier inside unless we experience some happiness. We cannot feel stronger inside unless we experience some strength. The doorway to changing neural structure due to experience-dependent neuroplasticity is to have the experience in the first place, either primarily because we notice we're already having it, or secondarily, sometimes we create it deliberately by thinking of something. Like I took you through previously, think of someone who cares about you. Right there, you're creating a positive experience. So step one, have the positive experience in the first place. Step two, get those neurons firing together so they wire together. Enrich it through the five well-known ways in science to build up learning, including emotional learning. Help it last longer. Duration, 5, 10, 20 seconds straight. Stay with it. Let yourself have it. Okay? Two, increase the intensity. All right? That's known to build up neural structure. Let it grow in your body. Give your mind over to it. Create sanctuary for it. Preserve it in your mind. Even if it's a subtle experience, like peacefulness or contentment, it can pervade the mind. Third, multimodality. Feel it in your whole body. You know, try to take the thought and help it become more emotional, more sensory. Maybe do something like sit up a little straighter for strength. Put your hand on your heart for compassion or love. Things like that. Fourth, novelty. That's well known. The brain is a big novelty detector. So the more that we pay attention to what could be fresh or new in a positive experience, the more we're going to build up its structure. We're in the business of trying to skillfully change our brain for the better. And then last, personal relevance, under the E for enrich, that will actually also build neural structure and learning. How is this relevant to me? Why should I care? How could it help me to be more self-compassionate? How could it help me to feel stronger inside when I go into work, right? That will help deepen its trace. Third, A, in HEAL, absorb. You can sense and intend that the experience is going into you, which will help prime memory systems. And then, if you want, you can link, you can hold both positive and negative material in awareness at once. That's a little trickier, it's a little riskier, it's a little harder, but it also has very high payoff. The first three steps are only positive, if you think about it. The fourth step is holding both positive and negative material in awareness at the same time. making the positive more prominent so that it associates with the negative. And then when we're no longer thinking about the negative event or no longer in touch with that negative feeling or point of view or old hurt or old wound, childhood issue or more recent issue, and that negative material goes back down the memory hole to be reconsolidated, it takes that positive material with it. That's the fourth step. There are three types of benefits in taking in the good. The first type is the particular good we take in. What would really help you these days to have more of inside you for a particular difficult situation or a long-standing issue or something you can see around the bend or a dream you've always wanted to fulfill but haven't felt sufficiently internally resourced to accomplish? What would help you these days? And then how can you activate that type of experience and then install it in your brain in the second, third, and optionally fourth step of taking in the good, right? So the first type of benefit is the particular good experiences you take in or the particular strengths inside you build up. That's great. Second, more generally, built into taking in the good is the implicit benefits of being on your own side, of treating yourself like you matter, of being an agent, being a hammer instead of a nail, when at a time when many of us feel pretty pushed around by outer events and our reactions to them. And also you're training your attention, because for the 10 or 20 or 30 seconds you're doing it any single time, right, you're getting more control over the spotlight of your own attention. And then the third type of benefit, which I think is really great, it's the maha bonus benefit. Through repeatedly taking in the good, you will gradually sensitize your brain to the good. Instead of the default, due to the negativity bias, of having a brain that's like Velcro for the bad, but Teflon for the good, a brain that's very good at learning from bad experiences, but bad at learning from good experiences, you reverse that through repeatedly taking in the good. Much as we can sensitize the brain to the bad, research is showing that we can actually sensitize it to the good as well. That's good news. You want to try this a couple of times? Okay. Most of the time when you take in the good, it's on the fly. It's not listening to a guy on a stage saying, okay, time to take in the good. Okay. And it's good to know that. That life is full of opportunities to take in the good. All right. On the other hand, there's a place for deliberately taking in the good, deliberately self-activating a positive state, and then really, really letting it sink in. That creates a wonderful positive cycle where you're activating the positive experience, installing it, reactivating it, drawing upon it as a resource inside when you need it. More caring, more happiness, more gratitude, more will, more strength, more sense of safety, more self-soothing, whatever. You reactivate it, which gives you then a chance to reinstall it ever more deeply. And then it's even easier to reactivate the time after that. This positive cycle proceeds. And then after a while, the emergence into consciousness of various inner strengths, like being able to control your attention or being able to recover from stressful experiences, those resources start activating more and more automatically and less deliberately. And even as they activate, as your brain gets stickier for the positive, they then sink in ever more deeply in a wonderful positive cycle. All right, so let's give it a try. So I'm just going to start with one thing. There's a method to my madness. We're going to do this three times, and then I'll explain why I did it this way. So the first one, if you can, call up the experience, have the experience of feeling strong. Recall a time, perhaps, when you were strong, physically perhaps, maybe a challenge in wilderness or at the end of a long race, or you were determined. You stood up for yourself or stood up for others. Or frankly, you just survived. Surviving is strength. It's underrated, but it's very important. You got through something really hard. So start playing around with, how do I activate or have in the first place some sense of strength? Maybe even helping yourself by sitting up a little straighter, not in some macho posture, but what's determination look like in your face, maybe in your eyes? And then once you have it, even if it's subtle, work with the second and third steps. Enrich it, stay with it. I'll be quiet in a moment. And meanwhile, sense and intend that this experience is sinking into you, even as you sink into it. Okay, so most of the times you take in the good are going to be quite short. Whatever happened for you, it's fine. Now I'm going to move to a second type of experience, all right? This one is gratitude. Think, if you can, about one or more things that you feel grateful for, thankful for, appreciative of. And then help yourself move from the idea of the blessings in your life, the people who are nice to you, the gift of life itself, your good fortune in various ways. Move from the idea of these facts to an experience of gratitude. What does gratitude feel like? You might internally strengthen this experience in enriching it by saying thank you. Thank you. You could also sense that gratitude is sinking in. You're becoming just a little bit more grateful in general as you help gratitude sink in. So here too, I'll be quiet for a bit. You're also learning what it's like to take in the good. What's it like to give yourself a good experience for a dozen seconds in a row? You might notice some blocks to doing it. Isn't that interesting? Come back to those later. You can also see what happens in terms of helping yourself become just a little different for the better from learning from a good experience. And then the third and last time, this last prompt, is think of a time when others wanted to include you. It could be a friend who said, hey, you want to have lunch? Or it could be someone who hired you. Maybe you were chosen for a sports team. It doesn't need to be the biggest thing in the world. You were invited to a Thanksgiving dinner. And what's it feel like to be included? To belong in some way. Maybe it's just going home for the holidays to your family. And then once you find the experience of belonging, part of the tribe, if you will, let yourself enrich and absorb that as well. We won't do anything with the fourth step today. Okay, coming back. Now, as I said, usually when we take in the good, it'll just be in the flow, right? It won't have this formal quality. The steps kind of really just mush together a lot. That's perfectly okay. It's often kind of quick. With kids, it's really quick in my personal experience. On the other hand, there's a lot to be said for taking the time when you're learning something new to unpack its different elements, to disentangle them. Or if you want to give yourself a nice gift, take some real minutes you know, before you go to bed or at another time in the day, and really, really, really let it sink in. All right. So any questions or comments about taking in the good so far? Yeah, right here. Oh, okay, so could I just talk about the fourth? I'll do it kind of quickly. I'll tell you a quick story about myself, and that would make sense. So briefly, I grew up, and I have a late birthday, and I skipped a grade, so I was very young going through school. And nothing horrible happened to me, but I had many, many experiences of feeling like an outsider, excluded, rejected, put down, ignored, dismissed, not valued. So the normal needs we have to feel seen or included, for me, were a very thin soup. Right, and I ended up in college with a hole in my heart. That's how it felt. Right? So then, somewhere in college, I realized, amazingly, to me it was like, are you kidding? Grow through pleasure? What? You know, I discovered that if I just let myself have these key experiences, and I'm going to bounce ahead to the next slide, and then I'll come back. In other words, experiences that were targeted at my need. Right, I didn't need to feel safer. That wasn't my issue. I didn't need to feel more grateful and accomplished. That wasn't my issue. I needed to feel more loved. Anybody else have that issue? Maybe? Yeah. You know, more narcissistic supplies in a healthy sense, more caring, more attention, more attunement. That was my vitamin C because I had scurvy. I didn't need iron, notwithstanding what Jan said. You know, I had scurvy. I needed my vitamin C. Okay, this was my vitamin C. And when I realized it, I started looking for it. What are you working on these days? What would help you? What's your vitamin C? It goes back to that question I asked earlier. In other words, what would make it better these days if you had more of it inside you? And then how can you start having the experiences that will grow that strength inside? That is incredibly useful. So, to your question, I would start having these experiences of being included. Often they were very modest. Most positive experiences, 0 to 10 scale, they're 1s and 2s. Some of them are 0.3s. Fine. Any port in a storm, you know what I mean? Ain't dead yet. That's a pretty good one right there. So I wanted to let it sink in. People would say, hey, you want to get some pizza? Great. Nobody ever invited me to anything when I was in high school. Good. You know, girl smiles at me. Wow, that was amazing. You know, some of them are even big. Most of them are pretty small. They happened. Good fact occurred. I wasn't making it up. A good fact occurred. I helped it become a good experience. Then, once I was feeling this good experience, right, I had activated the first two steps, I would very often get a sense as well of this younger part of me or this hurt or longing or sadness or mopey, wistful, looking through a wall of glass at other people having a good time. You know, many experiences I had, I would have a sense that those pained or hurt or wounded or hungry, longing parts of myself were being touched by this positive experience. In other words, I just held both in my mind at once. I had no idea why this was working for me, and it was transforming my life. Years later, as a psychologist, neuropsychologist kind of person, I now understand what's happening. Neurons that fire together wire together. I was building up neural structure through the first three steps, and when I linked the positive and negative material, when I just held both of them in awareness at once, I was driving the positive, because I kept it more prominent. I was driving the positive into the negative material, so then when the negative material went down the memory hole, it took the positive with it. And there are a lot of other examples of that. Yeah, great. Now, be careful. If you're doing the negative, you can't get hijacked by it. So using it for trauma, I don't think is a good idea. I don't think taking the good is good for severe depression because you can't self-activate a positive experience, although I do think physical pleasure is a very interesting opportunity for severe depression. But mild to moderate depression, many protocols use variations of taking in the good, often in not very clear ways, but it's implicit. I did not invent taking in the good. We all know how to take in the good. What's interested me is how to do it really well, really effectively. Half a dozen times a day, half a minute or less at a time. What does that add up to? 3 minutes or less. Okay, you can give me that at least. All right. Okay, one more person, then I'll move on. Yeah. Oh, that's very good. Okay. So is there anything about this work being this kind of structure-building process I'm talking about of taking the good is heightened by languaging it with others. Yes, there are multiple ways to enrich the experience, and one of them is sharing it with other people. So there's research on sharing good fortune with other people. Also, sometimes in culture, certain cultures really like to celebrate good things. Other cultures, interestingly, they're more introverted about it. It's more private to be really glad or appreciative. But yeah, I think sharing it with language can really help. But you know, it's funny to think about it. We privilege language in our culture, but if you imagine the volume of the brain is roughly 5 cups altogether, about 1,400 cubic centimeters, the volume of the brain neural structures devoted to language functions, roughly the volume of 3 fingers. 3 fingers, maybe 4 tops, compared to 5 cups altogether. Language is a very small part of our experiencing moment to moment, and that's just in terms of conscious processes, let alone unconscious processes. So a lot of people, as soon as they start using language, they're hijacked up into thought, and the experience, the other aspects of experience that are more sensate or emotional become lost. And very often, it's not really our thoughts that we suffer. It's what our thoughts make us feel or do or sense or want that makes us suffer. As a woman psychoanalyst said in the 30s, and I don't think it's an accident, it was a woman, it's kind of a rebuke to the male psychiatric psychoanalytic establishment. She said the patient does not need a new idea, a clever psychoanalytic interpretation. The patient does not need a new idea. The patient needs a new experience. So as long as languaging it is intensifying the totality of the experience, great. But be careful, because language can fairly quickly, as a language guy you probably have noticed, can just take you up into your head. Okay, so a couple quick points, because we are going to end close to 1:30, and I've got a couple more good things to go through, right? So just, you know, you might ask yourself in a general way, and this material is up on my website also if you want to look at it more deeply, what would help me to have more of inside these days? Whether it's dealing with my teenagers, or my stressful job, or this chronic pain I've got, or the prospect of aging, or losing others I love, what would help me more to have more of inside, and how can I grow it through deliberately activating and then internalizing positive experiences? Right? It's easy to underestimate the power of this practice, but I think that the brain is constantly changing its structure for better or worse. Why not take charge of that structure-building process ourselves? As the Buddha says here, think not lightly of good, saying, it will not come to me. Drop by drop is the water pot filled. Likewise, the wise one, gathering it little by little, fills oneself with good. Or as they say in Tibet, if you take care of the minutes, the years will take care of themselves. Right? Okay. So, love, right? Here it comes. Get ready. Oh, I told you. I told you. See, we have the mobile oxytocin detectors. Levels rising. Yeah. Guys have oxytocin too. We only have about 1/7 as much as women do, but we still have warm hearts. Can you see the fourth monkey? Oh, okay. Okay. So it's our nature. I mean, I just showed you a picture, right? And suddenly the whole room went, oh, you know, it's our nature. Here's another little example. Say, oh, right? 2 embodiments of loving kindness, compassion, Archbishop Desmond Tutu, His Holiness the Dalai Lama. Could have shown many other pictures. That was a particularly lively one, you know, the dynamic between them, and they're also quite archetypal figures, so I chose that one. The larger point is that it's natural for us to be caring and kind, and again, as much research is showing, it's good for us to be loving, caring, and kind. One of the primary ways that we've learned to come out of bursts of stress and back into our healthy resting state is through feeling connected and caring ourselves. So I want to do a little practice with you in which we build up that quality of caring and compassion, what's called loving kindness practice. So for starters, if you think about others who, even others who have wronged you or are difficult, you can think about their suffering too. I know for myself that if someone has wronged me objectively, it wasn't just my neurotic nuttiness. They really did mistreat me. It really did happen. Okay? There was also my neurotic nuttiness, but something really did happen. All right. So if I can reflect on their own suffering, it makes me feel better. I'm not letting them off the moral hook, you know. I may still call the police, I don't know, but anyway, but if it's necessary. But internally, I feel better. A little trick, you know, like if you want to go in front of people and talk to them, a way to just disarm yourself and help yourself feel more at ease about it is to look at their faces. I do this. And track people and see the stress, the strain, the weariness, the suffering. You can see it in my face, you know, just the tiredness or the pressure or the stress or the worry about on behalf of others. And by seeing that in others, it helps us feel better ourselves. So there are many ways to cultivate this. I mean, we could, again, do months on this, years, if not lifetimes. I'll just do a little tiny bit. There's a basic structure that has been very useful for many people about building up our loving capacities, including the capacity to love in the face of provocation. It's easy to love when other people are lovable. That's a no-brainer. You see a picture of four little sweet monkeys, that's an easy one. But, you know, I could show a picture of other people and there might be a very different reaction, you know, suddenly. But how can we have compassion for that person while also not letting them off the hook in terms of justice, if that's appropriate, how to do that. So there's some ways to build up the capacity, and a lot of studies show that you really can build up your capacity to wish others well as a kind of muscle. So I want to do a little practice with you, if you're up for it. We'll start with someone easy, then we'll raise the bar a bit, and then, what the heck, I'm going to go for it. We're going to choose the difficult person, sometimes an enemy. There's a range of difficult people, you know, from mild to moderate to severe. Pick your person and then see what it's like to wish that person well. Now, sometimes wishing a person well is difficult, is in the form of, I wish you would find the happiness inside that would enable you to not be such a jerk. But there's some truth to it. All right? It's okay. I'm including that. This is not sentimentality. This is real, you know? If you felt truly happy inside, you wouldn't be such a war criminal. And I'm not trivializing that at all. But you know what I mean? So you can help. The point is to help yourself. If you can't do it, you just can't do it. All right? But let's play around with it. So, for starters, as studies have shown, warm up your own neural circuits by beginning with feeling cared about. You're self-activating a state of mind again, although you might bring in a sense of being cared about that's already present. Maybe you're with someone who cares about you here, or you just have a background sense of being part of a family, being cared about. And then on the basis of that, pick someone you like a lot. Maybe you're very grateful to, sometimes called a benefactor. Someone you like a lot. Could be your partner, your mate, a child. And internally, feel if you can mobilize kindness toward that person, the wish that they be happy. Maybe with thoughts in your mind like, may you be happy, or something very specific, like, oh, may you get a home run next week, Johnny, or, you know, oh, may you have so much fun on your vacation. Or may you be healthy or safe or live with ease. knowing what it's like to deliberately be warm-hearted, to wish others well, and then picking someone who is neutral for you, like a stranger, or maybe someone you don't know well at all, like a neighbor who lives far down the street, or someone you pass routinely every day at work, like selling newspapers outside at a kiosk. Could be just someone random in this room. So then with regard to that person, call it the neutral person, that person too could be someone that you send kindness to, good wishes to. It's quite powerful, actually, to go through your day with I think of it as hit-and-run kindness, you know, where you look at people and you just beam them. You just wish them well for their sake and certainly for your own. So I'll be quiet as you just play around with this with a neutral person. And then the deeper end of the pool. So if you like, pick someone, maybe on a spectrum, who's difficult for you. Maybe someone you love, who just is aggravating, or lately been. Or it could be someone who's wronged you, or someone who's always difficult around, maybe because they have they're an authority figure in your life. Or maybe they've really, really harmed you, really, and gotten away with it scot-free to really raise the challenge bar here. So decide for yourself how much you want to challenge yourself. And then see if you can explore what it's like for yourself, for your own well-being, your own relief, to wish that person well, that they be truly happy, soul happy, deep down, at ease. See what that's like. See if you can find a kind of freedom, a sort of self-care in wishing them to be truly at peace. You're not giving up your view of the facts, the circumstances, the values that have been violated. And simultaneously, for your own sake, you're exploring what it's like to actually wish that they find true happiness. Okay, coming back. It's interesting, isn't it, to explore what that could be like in a way that doesn't give up your moral view, doesn't let the other off the hook, certainly doesn't falsify reality, but simultaneously, for your own sake, and maybe for benevolence as well, to find your way to wishing a difficult person well. All right. So we're on the home stretch. I want to do the next bit for the next 10 minutes or so, maybe even a smidge less, and then we'll move to a wrap. Okay? So I want to talk here, the fifth suggestion I have, which has to do with a way of understanding the evolution of the brain. The brain essentially evolved like a house in three floors. The first floor being the brainstem, to simplify. Second floor being the subcortical regions that sit on top. The third floor being the cortex, which is very loosely associated with the reptilian, early mammalian, and then primate, and human stages of evolution. And these three floors, again, very loosely associated with the first most fundamental need of all, which is to avoid harms. Rule one in the wild is eat lunch today, don't be lunch today. Right? Then we have up here the second major need, to approach rewards, get those carrots. And third, to attach to others. Now, ancient worms, reptiles, and fish were attaching to others for mating purposes, typically. It was pretty simplistic. They were doing all three things. But those three needs were really elaborated over the course of evolution. So we have three basic needs, three fundamental operating systems in the brain. Okay, so far, we need to feel safe. We need to feel satisfied, broadly defined. We need to feel connected. We have other needs, but most of our needs really do slot into one or more of those three systems. So we don't have a choice about the three systems. Whether we're a sinner or a saint, we don't have a choice. Our choice is what setting are we in? And as you'll see in a moment, the brain basically has two settings in terms of these three fundamental systems or needs. One setting is our home base. When we experience that those needs are met, when we experience being basically safe, basically satisfied and fulfilled, basically fed, and third, basically connected enough, liked enough, loved enough. When that's our experience, the brain defaults to its resting state. The resting state of a system is its home base. In this homeostatic, which just means sustainable, resting state, the body refuels itself, it recovers from bursts of stress, it repairs itself, and the mind is colored broadly in terms of those three fundamental systems with peace, contentment, and love. That's good news. It's also a brain, interestingly, with very little drive. There's very little sense of deficit or disturbance when we're in the responsive mode of the brain, the green zone, if you will, of the brain. And for those of you that have a background in this territory, you can see I'm trying to ask myself and operationalize at the neurobiological level, what would be the brain that doesn't have the craving in it that leads to suffering and harm? Craving broadly defined as aversion or grasping or clinging, based on an underlying sense of deficit, lack, or disturbance. Okay? The good news is that this is our resting state. Little graphic here. On the other hand, there is a second state of the brain, which evolved to deal with short-term emergencies, challenges to survival. So when we experience that our three basic needs are not met, we feel disturbed by threat, loss, or rejection. In other words, we don't feel a sense of safety, satisfaction, or connection. The body fires up into its fight-or-flight stress response. Long-term projects are put on hold, and the mind is colored in traditional language with hatred, greed, and heartache. Or in more conventional language, fear and anger, disappointment and frustration, or loneliness, hurt, or shame, or envy, aggression, etc., because we're very social creatures. This is the brain, and it's called allostatic, where we accumulate the impact of the wear and tear of stressful bursts, reactive mode, which is the underlying neurobiological basis for craving. If you think about it, a state of deficit. All right, got a graphic here, and then here's a question. We don't have a choice about the three systems. We're always focused on avoiding harms, approaching rewards, and attaching to others. Those needs are neutral. They're just needs. That's what it's like to be an animal, all right? Whether you're a lizard or a mouse or a monkey or a human being. Personally, when I think about brainstem, subcortex, cortex, I think about my personal inner lizard, mouse, and monkey. You know, you ever notice the zoo inside? And those different aspects of us, which use the whole brain, okay, today I'm simplifying, but it's a useful fiction, you know, they have different needs. And the more that we're dealing with our more primal needs for safety, the more learning we need, because those lower parts of the brain are not very good at neuroplasticity. They're slow learners. Or to put it concretely, the lizard needs a lot of petting. poor lizard, sweet lizard. I grew up in Southern California, a lot of lizards there, rub their bellies, lizard time. Right? The rat, the mouse, needs a fair amount of cheese, and that monkey sure needs a lot of hugging. Okay? So that's a way to understand ourselves. And when we do that, we come home to happiness, to the responsive mode of the brain. Right? So the nice thing, I'm going to bounce to my next slide, we'll send it to you. It's about how gradually internalizing positive experiences and gradually internalizing the experience of the responsive mode builds up an unconditional well-being and happiness over time. We don't turn to these experiences to crave them. We actually bring the craving to an end by repeatedly resting again and again and again in a fundamental sense of peace, contentment, and love in terms of the avoiding, approaching, and attaching systems of the brain. That's not full awakening. We need to bring in morality. We need to bring in insight. We need to bring in the heart, which, of course, comes here as well. But it's sure a good foundation for it. So as a final bit here, and then we'll move to a wrap, I propose to do with you a little practice I do with myself routinely, which is to activate and then rest in a basic sense of peace, contentment, and love as a way to come home to happiness. Want to try that? There we go. So, as usual, on command, could you please feel peaceful? In other words, you might want to exhale. The parasympathetic wing of the nervous system handles exhaling. That'll help you relax. You might bring to a mind a sense of protection, maybe a sense of strength, a calming, anything that will help you activate aspects of the experience of peace. There may be agitation, there might be other thoughts, plans, worries skittering around, but they can be held in a context of an underlying peace. Even the field of awareness itself is innately peaceful, because it's always undisturbed by what it holds. Finding your way into a basic sense of peace. And have a sense of any kind of fighting or fear falling away right now, resting in peace. Not disturbed, resting in peace. And letting the sense of peace, whatever it is, move to the background, maybe to continue growing. And then bringing into mind things that make you feel happy. Perhaps a soft, sweet happiness of gratitude. Maybe a sense of accomplishing things. Maybe just simply a sense of the fullness of this moment, the enoughness of it. So there's no need. Disappointment falls away, frustration falls away, and there can be a growing contentment, a sense of well-being, while letting this moment be just what it is, with no wish for it to change in any way. Contentment. Finding your way into a basic contentment. Helping yourself feel increasingly happy. There may be sadness, there may be worry, there may be pain, but held in a field of well-being increasingly, with frustration falling away, drivenness falling away. No need to strain to get more. No goals need to be accomplished right now. Contentment. And then letting whatever contentedness has arisen move to the background, also perhaps to continue growing. Last, see if you can bring your attention to some sense of love. Either feeling loved or feeling loving, because love is love, whether it's flowing in or out. So perhaps bringing to mind yet again feelings of being cared about. Sinking in that deep longing being fulfilled. People do like you. People do love you. People have loved you. You might reflect on being connected to all life or to other humans or to the natural world altogether, connected. No need to chase connection. Also being aware of your own warm-heartedness, your own compassion for others, your own kindness for others, your own lovingness. So be quiet for a few moments as you just rest in love, letting clinging fall away, letting chasing love fall away, abiding as love in love. And then for the last minute, seeing what it's like to rest in a combination of peace, contentment, and love as your natural home. There might be a sense of coming home to this state in which there's really no need for any kind of drivenness, any kind of warding off or bracing. There's no need for any feelings of rejection or inadequacy. It really isn't. Right now, you're resting in your home base, your natural home of peace, contentment, and love as a global, integrated way of being. You might let it land and sink in. Wow, this is my home. Home again. It's good to be home. And then maybe even imagining going forward today or the week to come from your home base, from the green zone, from the responsive mode of the brain. Peace, contentment, and love. Okay, moving to a wrap altogether. So it's okay to, of course, feel at home, at ease, even as you engage life on the basis of the responsive mode. Jan and I are very glad at how you've engaged us. Isn't he great? All right, thank you. Great. It's a wrap. And now you can go out and take your glutathione and come from peace, contentment, and love. And thank you for all your support for the Wellspring Institute. And thanks to the volunteers, the assistants, Michelle Keane, everybody. Thank you. And Jen and I will stick around.